Today at Reader's Corner, baseball historian Neil Lankto, author of Campy, The Two Lives of Roy Campanella.
Campy just could do so many things well. Behind the plate, he just was a great handler of pitchers. He also had just an unbelievable throwing arm. He was just so far above his contemporaries. He was born in 1921, therefore he was young enough to take advantage of integration when it came along. But he knew if he had been born even 3, 4, 5 years earlier, he wouldn't have been. He had a difficult personal life, and after the accident, it was very, very difficult for him to adjust to being a quadriplegic, particularly difficult for someone who had been so physical, and his whole life had been baseball.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Joe DiMaggio called Roy Campanella a wizard. The famously cantankerous Ty Cobb referred to him as the best catcher in baseball. A mere 3 years after becoming the second African-American to join the Brooklyn Dodgers, Campanella was named the National League's most valuable player and later helped guide the Brooklyn Dodgers to their first ever World Series victory in a classic match with the New York Yankees. Neil Lankto has written a new biography of the Hall of Fame catcher that has been hailed as the most authoritative study of his life ever published. Campy, The Two Lives of Roy Campanella, explores his pioneering career, marked with triumphs and disappointments, as well as his patience and charm in the face of condescension, contempt, and bigotry. It also details the second part of his life as a quadriplegic following a career-ending accident. With spring training just around the corner, and baseball fans everywhere looking forward to another season, today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Dr. Lankto, a recipient of the Seymour Medal from the Society for American Baseball Research. He teaches modern American history at the University of Delaware. He is a lifelong fan of the Boston Red Sox and resides in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Dr. Lankto joined us by phone for this interview. Neil Lankto, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk about Campanella. What an interesting guy. What is it about Roy Campanella as a catcher that caused Ty Cobb to say he was the best catcher in baseball?
Well, Campy just could do so many things well. I mean, a lot of people remember his offense, but behind the plate, he just was a great handler of pitchers. He had that psychology. As far as he was a psychologist, he could just deal with the idiosyncrasies of each of the pitchers he had to catch. He also had just an unbelievable throwing arm. I mean, he was throwing runners out at a percentage of 60-70%, which is very, very high. He was just so far above his contemporaries. And he could just do everything well behind the plate. He could block pitches. He could call a game well. And as you said, Ty Cobb, who had no use for not only black players, but he had no use for the modern player of the 50s. So for him to praise him was really a remarkable thing.
Why is it that Campy might have been the first black player to integrate baseball?
Well, during World War II, and this was before Branch Rickey got into the whole integration stuff, there was a great push to integrate the major leagues simply because, you know, we were fighting a war on fascism and oppression abroad. And a lot of advocates and activists thought, you know, Major League Baseball, how long can they get away with their continued color line? So there was a great push in 1942, right after the war started, to integrate. And the commissioner of baseball, Commissioner Landis, finally cracked and said, all right, there's no rule. Major League teams can sign black players. And one team, the Pittsburgh Pirates, took him at his word. They promised there would be a tryout, and they actually named three players. And one of them was Roy Campanella, who was at that point already a star in the Negro Leagues. So Campy could have had that shot, but what happened was the Pirates got cold feet. Someone put a lot of pressure on them, whether it was Commissioner Landis or the other owners, and the Pirates backed out, and Campy never got that shot that he could have got several years before Robinson. Campy, I think, always thought he could have been and should have been the first to integrate the majors.
Well, let's do talk about that relationship. I want to go back and talk a little bit about Campanella's early life as well. But since we're on Jackie Robinson, let's talk about the two of them. Contrast and compare them for us.
Well, these are two very different men. You know, two very different men. Campy had very little education. He was a dropout, ninth grade dropout. Jackie went to college. He didn't graduate, but he did do some time in California, in UCLA. So Jackie was much more well-rounded, educated, had a lot of interest outside of baseball, whereas Campy loved one thing, baseball. That was his whole life. But having said that, they were friends when they first met each other in the 40s. You know, they both were signed by the Dodgers within 6 months of one another. They were very close for a while. They roomed together on the Dodgers. They even bought homes in the same neighborhood. But then issues started to break them apart. One of them was the issue of money, which always seems to break friendships apart. Campy and Jackie were doing a barnstorming tour. Jackie took a team out, and Campy found out that Jackie was getting paid a lot more than he was, and that really rubbed in the wrong way. And the other thing that broke them apart was civil rights issues. Jackie was really on the forefront of that. He wanted to speak out. He wanted to use his position as an elite black player to speak out about that issue. And Campy did not. Campy said, I'm no politician. I'm no crusader. I don't want to speak out against it. And most black players and most black celebrities in the 50s took the standpoint of Campanella, that they were very fortunate, didn't want to rock the boat. But Jackie got very irritated with that, to the point that Campy and Jackie just stopped speaking for years over that very issue.
Did they ever reconcile before their passings?
They did reconcile. In fact, there's a nice picture in the book of Campy and Jackie at Campy's liquor store. Campy had a liquor store in Harlem in 1964, burying the hatchet, because by that point, Campy had really come around to Jackie's way of thinking. I think he realized that, you know, the slow stance of waiting was not going to work. So Campy really developed his own ideology over time about civil rights, and that's why he and Jackie did finally make up in the 60s. So they did become friends again in the last 7 or 8 years of Jackie's life.
Now, we talk, of course, about Campanella going into the Negro Leagues. You discuss in your book that he went in at age 15, but Campanella was really the son of a white father and a black mother. Talk about his upbringing in Philadelphia.
Yeah, that was one of the things I wish I could have found out more, when they actually, his parents actually met. I mean, it was obviously a very, very rare thing in those days, an interracial marriage. I don't know how these two got together, but somehow they got together and it worked. Now, there are two sides of the family. Neither side was too happy about it, the African-American side and the Italian side, and there was some disowning that went on, apparently. Campy, however, I think always self-identified as African-American, because in those days, if you had a drop of black blood, you were considered to be black. So I think Campy always did. But having said that, he was very proud of the Italian side of his family, and I think he always looked up to his parents' marriages. Yeah, it was a very successful marriage. They stayed together for, I don't know, 50, 60 years. And he always thought his father was a wonderful man. So, I mean, I think it worked out well for him. But as I said, he pretty much did self-identify as African-American.
And who were young Campy's baseball heroes as he was growing up?
Well, you know, they weren't black players, interestingly enough. He grew up in North Philadelphia in a neighborhood called Nicetown. And Nicetown was very close to where the Philadelphia Phillies and Philadelphia A's played. So he would go and sit in the bleachers when he was a little kid and watch the major league teams come to town. And he was taken by the catchers. He loved Bill Dickey, who was a Hall of Fame catcher with the Yankees. And he loved Mickey Cochran, who was another great catcher for the Philadelphia Athletics and Detroit Tigers in the 1930s. Those were his heroes. In fact, he said later on, he said, I don't think I ever saw a Negro League game until I got in the Negro Leagues. It just wasn't really part of his development. And I think it's not surprising, because the media in those days was so much. It was the major leagues, and the Negro League media was very, very small. So it's not surprising he didn't know too much about it when he was growing up.
Well, you wrote a book, as I mentioned in the intro, Negro League Baseball Chronicles from the History of Organized Black Baseball, 33 to the early 60s. I'm curious, how many more black players were there or could there have been in the Negro Leagues who didn't get the chance that Campy and Jackie got? In other words, did the majors eventually get all the major league qualified black players there were out there, or were there lines and lines of them that just didn't get in because there was obviously a quota system where no club, especially in the 50s, was going to take more than, you know, one or two or three?
I think there was a quota system in the early 50s, in that I think most teams, if they were going to take them, didn't want two or more than two or three. Even the Dodgers, it was a big issue every year when they would add another one. You know, it was like, oh, they're going to three this year. Can they have another one? They're going to four. I mean, every year they increased, but there was always this fear they were going to lose attendance or lose possible players might not want to come to their team. You know, the one thing about the Negro Leagues, it was all a matter of timing as well. You know, Campy always recognized this fact that he was born in 1921. Therefore, he was young enough to take advantage of integration when it came along. But he knew if he had been born even 3, 4, 5 years earlier, he wouldn't have been. I mean, the big one everyone talks about is the great catcher, Josh Gibson, probably one of the greatest baseball players of all time, great catcher. And he was born 10 years before Campy. and died right before integration occurred. And Gibson was someone who actually took an interest in Campy when Campy first joined the league. He thought it was cute that there was a 15-year-old kid trying to catch. And Gibson took a liking to Campy, but within a few years, Campy was almost as good as Gibson. But Campy always said later on, he said, anything I could do on the ball field, Josh Gibson could do better, and that he should have gotten that chance, and it's a pity he didn't. So it really was on timing, and it was on in the 50s. A lot of teams were getting into it as far as signing players, but very, very reluctantly and very slowly. And I think you really had to be a better-than-average player to make it to the major leagues if you were Black in those years.
What made you want to write about Campy?
I thought he had a great story, basically. There are a couple of things. I thought his story was very fascinating. The 15-year-old who's biracial and plays in the Negro Leagues, integrates the majors almost right after Robinson, and then the story of his accident. So that appealed to me, and also the fact that there really hadn't been anything substantial written on him in years. There was an autobiography called It's Good to Be Alive, written right after his accident, which came out in 1959. And then there was a TV movie that maybe some of your listeners might remember from the 70s, starring Paul Winfield. And that's really what most people remember about Campy. There had been nothing really, as I said, substantial written on him. So I thought his story was interesting and that the time was right to, you know, take another look at his life.
And his autobiography had some problems, didn't it? I mean, there were some inaccuracies and maybe he mythologized a little bit.
I think that's probably true with any autobiography. I think if you subject it to a historian's scrutiny, most autobiographies are very, very self-serving. Campy was like anyone else. He didn't write it, obviously. It was very heavily ghostwritten by a couple of sports writers, and they did some picking and choosing through his background, and then there were a couple of new things here and there. But, you know, it was a book that tried to put his own spin on what he wanted the public to see him as. So you have to keep that in mind when you're going through his autobiography. And I tried to. I mean, I used parts of his autobiography. Some of it was okay to use, but a lot of it was, as I said, the way he wanted the public to see him. And Campy was a master at PR. I mean, he was someone who was very media-friendly, very media-savvy, much more so than Jackie Robinson, which I think probably irritated Jackie at times.
Well, whether it's trying to catch up on what the Negro Leagues were all about or trying to catch up on the era that Campy and Jackie Robinson lived in, many of us are familiar with Ken Burns' work, the 10 DVDs that I've watched them and have really enjoyed the history of baseball. How good of a source is that for those of us who are just trying to get a feel for what it was like back in those days?
I mean, I think they're okay as a source. I mean, Ken Burns is a filmmaker. He's not a historian, and he's a great filmmaker. And what I mean by that, though, sometimes he will take a story that maybe a historian might not necessarily think is true and use it in his documentaries, or he'll use an image which doesn't necessarily match with what he's saying on screen. So I think they're a great introduction. I mean, I use them in my classes as a professor, and I think it's good for people to see visual representation of a certain period. But I think if you really want to understand the period, the era, I think you've got to, you know, go to the books and do the reading. I mean, really the best source to learn about that era in African-American life and African-American sports are the Black newspapers of the time. They are just a great, great source. I mean, they came out every week. The big cities around the country had them, and they really tell the story of what exactly was going on, and they give you a really full flavor of the era.
You're listening to Neil Lankto. He's the author of Campy, The Two Lives of Roy Campanella. Neil, I'd like to talk for a moment, if we could, about Campy actually breaking in. We all know the many stories about what Jackie Robinson had to endure when he broke in because he was the first. How different was it for the second? How much grief and abuse did Campy take compared to Robinson coming in just a year after Jackie did?
Well, the one thing you have to remember is that Branch Rickey, the president general manager of the Dodgers, who engineered this whole thing, had told all the Black players that they absolutely could not fight back. They had to simply put up with whatever was thrown in their face. So, and Campy always knew that, and for that reason, he always called you had to walk a chalk line. You could not deviate from that. When he was in the minors in '46, he was sent to Nashua, New Hampshire, which was a northern city, very, very few Black people, period. The fans were pretty good to him. There were a few racial incidents with other teams. There was a case where a player threw a handful of dirt in his face, and Campy pretty much held his tongue, but he threatened. He said, if you do that again, I'm going to break every bone in your body. And he kind of diffused it on that basis. In 47, he went to Montreal. That was, you know, Jackie was his first year in Brooklyn. And in the International League, which is a high-level minor league, and there was a lot of racial crap thrown at him from opposing teams in particular. I talked to one of his teammates, a guy named Butch Boyd, who said it was as bad as what Jackie put up with, that the opposing teams just gave it to him so bad. And that Campy just wouldn't say anything. He just took it. And he performed well on the field. So he had a very, very tough time in those years in the minors. When he came up in 48, I think things were a little bit better in the majors because Jackie had been there for a year. But there were still issues even on the Dodgers. When Campy first came up, there were pitchers who would not take his signals. There was a guy named Hugh Casey who pitched for the Dodgers. He was an old Southerner. And Casey basically said, I'm not going to take orders from a black catcher. So Campy said, well, just throw anything you want. You know, he wouldn't even let him put a signal down. So he just had to catch anything that Casey threw at him. So that kind of thing was still going on. I think it got better, though, as the 40s and 50s progressed on the Dodgers and in the National League. But there were still cases of racial abuse from the fans and racial abuse from other players.
Well, let's talk about Campanella after he leaves the major leagues. And this is a sad tale that's been told more than once. I mean, he really didn't exactly lead an exemplary personal life. And as a matter of fact, you even point out in your book that the night of the accident might have been an example of that, what he was doing and where he was going or coming from. Talk to us about Campanella after he leaves the majors. And I can't help but to really feel sorry for these guys who have such a difficult time adjusting to life outside of baseball on the field.
It's more common than you would think. Campy had a very, as I say, a pretty messy personal life. He had three marriages. First wife he married when he was very, very young. She got pregnant. Second marriage was right when he was becoming famous. That marriage is starting to fall apart. And as you mentioned, when he got into the car accident in 1958, that's something I dug up in this book, because the car accident has been spun a certain way, that Campy was driving home and that he simply lost control of his car on the ice. And I was able to determine that Campy actually had been at the home of another woman that night who he was having an affair with, then drove home, and then fell asleep at the wheel. And this came from a couple of cops who were still living who were there that night, and they said that's what they thought happened. So it was a story that never came out at the time, but I was able to dig up. And it certainly tells us a lot about how the media has changed in this day and age. The whole world would know about it 2 seconds after it happened, but in those days, you know, the journalists protected the celebrities and the athletes and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, Campy had he had a difficult personal life, and after the accident, it was very, very difficult for him to adjust to being a quadriplegic, which, of course, is not surprising, but also it was particularly difficult for someone who had been so physical, and his whole life had been baseball, and that had been taken from him. He could not do what he wanted to do, and this was someone who thought he was going to stay in baseball his whole life. I think he envisioned being one of the first black manager, at least a coach with the Dodgers, and all this was taken from him. And he was very angry and very bitter for a number of years afterwards, and that's something that the public didn't know about either, because Campy publicly, as someone once told me, always had a smile on his face. Everything was fine, everything was great, and that was the side he presented to the public. But he did have a certain amount of torment at times, and again, particularly the accident, which is not surprising at all.
This whole issue of modern baseball players versus the old-timers is interesting, because how many times have I been in conversations with baseball fans where they're always glorifying the stars of the past and then comparing them and then running down the guys today who, of course, are in the paper the minute they run a red light. And I suppose there's some that would even criticize you as a writer and say, oh, well, you know, why do you have to go and dredge up all this stuff? But I think it really helps put baseball, or for that matter, anything, in perspective, that maybe things today aren't really that different than they were in the days of old. It's just that in the days of old, reporters weren't following it or finding it or at least reporting it. What do you think?
I think you're definitely correct. In fact, there were some criticisms of me on that basis, that what some reviewer said it was like learning there was no such thing as Santa Claus to read some of these things in the book. And I don't agree with that, because I think people, as you said, I think people have made these past ball players into squeaky clean, Jack Armstrong, whatever, legend, you know, who never did anything wrong. But they did. Of course they did. And, you know, I talked to Roger Kahn, who wrote The Boys of Summer, and Roger Kahn was there. He said this, of course this stuff went on. I asked him why he did not reported, he said, we just did not, you know, we had a relationship with the players in those days. Like, they travel with them, and they just, it was understood you just didn't divulge that kind of stuff. It went on, maybe not quite as bad as today, but certainly it went on. It's probably been going on as long as there have been athletes, you know, sure, making money in America. So, yeah, I think we do try to get more unnecessarily nostalgic about the past, not just in baseball, but other things too. And I tried to convey that in the book, that, you know, things were different, obviously, in the 50s, but in some ways the sports world has not changed as much as we think it has.
Well, you know, it's not, as you say, it's not just baseball. Reporters knew a lot more about John F. Kennedy's life in the White House than they were reporting back in those
days,
too.
Exactly.
So Campanella has this accident, and he becomes a quadriplegic. Help us understand how he reacts to this man larger than life, professional athlete. Now, of course, he's running a liquor store, and he's retired from baseball. He's not retired from baseball when he has the accident, right?
No, he's not.
No, what retires him.
Yeah, was the Dodgers were preparing to move to Los Angeles. It was the winter of 58, right after the Dodgers had finished their last season in Brooklyn. So he was going to Los Angeles in a couple of months. And, his whole life changed, obviously, at that moment. I mean, and what's interesting is that he really, in some ways, it's hard to say lucky, but he was lucky he was injured at the time he was, because a few years earlier, maybe even a decade earlier, quadriplegics just died so quickly. I mean, their life expectancy was so short. But it happened at the time when they were making some breakthroughs as far as treatments were concerned, and also things like the development of antibiotics during World War II allowed quadriplegics to live a lot longer. Because prior to that, they would just get infections and die very quickly. So Campy, as it turned out, was moved to this cutting-edge place in New York called the Institute of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, where this guy named Dr. Howard Rusk, who was the go-to guy as far as treating quadriplegics. And he really got Campy to realize that he could still live a productive life in a wheelchair. So that was a big thing for him. But having said that, there were times I think he was very depressed, almost suicidal, in the first couple of years after that accident. And it took a while for him to come out of that. And he spent 35 years in the chair. It's a long time to live in a wheelchair. If we look on our own time and compare him to, say, Christopher Reeve, who I don't think even lived a decade. So it's still, you know, the life expectancy is not always that long, even with today's better treatment. So it was a long time to spend in the wheelchair, and I think it says something about his will to live, even after all that horrible accident.
Now, when you describe him as a quadriplegic after the accident, and then you talk about these new techniques of physical therapy, did he become something different than a full quadriplegic? Did he regain the use of any motion in his arms, for example, as a result of this new physical therapy?
Not really. What they explained to me, and I spoke to some of the individuals who work with him, is that they just try to get you to maximize what you have left. In other words, whatever muscles and nerves were not damaged, you know, they try to get you to be able to use those better. So he was never able to. He could kind of shrug his shoulders a little bit and kind of hunch a little bit. He could kind of put his hands together and kind of shove things. I mean, that was the extent of what he could do. But that was, you know, just to be able to do that was a huge improvement. When he first came in, he couldn't even move. I mean, just to get him to be able to sit in a wheel. I mean, it was a whole process. So, I mean, he never really, he wasn't quadriplegic for life. He was, I mean, that never changed. But I think what's important about him particularly is that he was public with it. You know, he was really one of the first celebrities to go out and about in a wheelchair and show the world that you can do it. I mean, someone like Roosevelt, for example, who was in a wheelchair and really hid that from the public in the 40s and 30s, Campy, I think, was one of the first who really, as I said, was out there. He was seeing a lot of games. He did a lot of appearances. And I think he did help what was then called, they called it the handicapped in those days, but the handicapped community, I think, benefited from him. And I think he started speaking out about things like ramps and things that we take for granted today. I mean, this is pre-American with Disabilities Act stuff. So, I mean, it was a very difficult time in the 60s and 70s until that came along. And he was very, very public with that issue.
Tell us about how he kicked off the season opener in a Dodger game after his accident, where he threw out the first pitch.
Yeah, well, he had the accident in 58, and in 59 they brought him out to Los Angeles, and there were two things he did. First, they had him throw out the first ball, which the fans went crazy over that, because he was able to do it by wrapping his arms around the ball and kind of shoving it, and that was a huge appearance for him. And then about a few weeks later, they did a benefit for him at the Coliseum in Los Angeles, where they drew 93,000 fans, which was then a record, number of people to attend a baseball game to honor him. And they wheeled him out there, and then everyone lit a little candle, a little match, which they would never do today, of course. And the whole stadium was bathed with light. It was just an unbelievable show of love for this man who had never played in Los Angeles, but everyone really was pulling for him. You know, so it was a great appearance for Camp, and he never forgot that.
I think you said in your book that he continued throughout his life to be a force for change in baseball and in the world. In what sense for baseball?
I think just showing that African Americans were capable of playing baseball. I mean, he was a black catcher, and that was a big thing because it was believed that, you know, maybe they can play baseball, but they can't play a thinking man's position like catcher. And Camp even ran up against this. There were writers and some players who said, oh, he might be able to catch, but he doesn't know what he's doing behind the plate. He can't think. You know, he's a black guy. But Campy undermined that stereotype by being one of the smartest baseball men on the field, someone who was always thinking three pitches ahead. So I think he really crushed that stereotype. And also just performing well and being a very beloved figure. I mean, I think he was one of the first black players who was really, really loved by the public. I mean, Jackie was a great player, but he wasn't loved. He just didn't have that kind of personality, didn't have that persona, that larger-than-life friendly, teddy bearish quality that Campy did. Campy was liked by just about everyone, white or black. And I think in that way, he probably helped some white fans who never thought they would like a black player. He was kind of the breakthrough in that sense.
Every now and then, when I see an African-American come up to the plate, I wonder, gee, does this guy really understand what it took for him to get there? But you hang around baseball players, I would assume, or you certainly are a fan of the game. What's your thoughts on the extent to which today we, those of us who are fans, whether we're fans or whether we're on the field, do we really have the respect, and actually this is what your book is trying to do, I guess, the respect for those who came before and really were the trailblazers?
I don't think the players do, white or black for that matter.
Yeah.
The average major league player probably could barely even name who Babe Ruth is.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not interested in history. So I remember a few years back, this might have been in the 80s or 90s, and they were asking some of the players about who Jackie Robinson was, and some of them did not know who he was. So, I mean, we're generalizing, of course, and there are some who probably are students of the game, but I would say by and large, the average player doesn't know a whole lot about the history of baseball and probably doesn't care that much either. As the public is concerned, I think the public is certainly becoming more well-informed about the Negro Leagues in the last 20 years. When I was doing research on it in the early 90s, there was not a whole lot written about it, not a whole lot of interest. I think that's really changed. I think, you know, like Ken Burns' stuff with Buck O'Neill has helped that a lot. And then there's the museum in Kansas City. So I think there is a greater appreciation of the Negro League pioneers and what they did. So I think that's something we can point to in 2011.
Well, thanks to you for the job you've played in helping us understand that, and in particular, the life and times of Roy Campanella. Neil Langto, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me on.
Again, the book is Campy, The Two Lives of Roy Campanella. I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Neil Langto. Next week, investigative reporter Michael Graybell, author of Money Well Spent, The Truth Behind the Trillion-Dollar Stimulus, The Biggest Economic Recovery Plan in History. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.